So this morning we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, verses 37, which I think is up there, and all, but actually also 38, because 37 does not have a purport or commentary. So, a bit odd. Okay, so of course the translation. The controlling deities of all the above-mentioned physical elements are empowered expansions of Lord Vishnu. They are embodied by eternal time under the external energy, and they are his parts and parcels. Because they were entrusted with different functions of universal duties and were unable to perform them, they offered fascinating prayers to the Lord as follows. So we won't find out what those are, those prayers, until tomorrow, I imagine, but we'll continue. So, purport. Pashur Prabhupada Kijai. The conception of various controlling demigods who inhabit the higher planetary systems for the management of universal affairs is not imaginary, as proposed by persons with a poor fund of knowledge. The demigods are expanded parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord Vishnu, and they are embodied by time, external energy, and partial consciousness of the Supreme. Human beings, animals, birds, etc., are also parts and parcels of the Lord and have different material bodies, but they are not the controlling deities of material affairs. They are rather controlled by such demigods. Such control is not superfluous. It is as necessary as the controlling departments in the affairs of a modern state. The demigods should not be despised by the controlling living beings. They are all great devotees of the Lord, entrusted to execute certain functions of universal affairs. One may be angry with Yamaraj for his thankless task of punishing the sinful souls, but Yamaraj is one of the authorized devotees of the Lord, and so are all the other demigods. A devotee of the Lord is never controlled by such demigods whose function as assistants of the Lord, but he shows them all respects on account of the responsible positions to which they have been appointed by the Lord. At the same time, a devotee of the Lord does not foolishly mistake them to be the Supreme Lord. Only foolish persons accept the demigods as being on the same level as Vishnu. Actually, they are all appointed as servants of Vishnu. Anyone who places the Lord and the demigods on the same level is called a Pashandi, or an atheist. The demigods are worshipped by persons who are more or less adherents to the process of Gyan, Yoga and Karma, i.e., in other words, the impersonalists, the meditators and fruitive workers. The devotees, however, worship only the Supreme Lord Vishnu. This worship is not for any material benefit, as desired by all the materialists, even up to the salvationists, mystics, and fruitive workers. Devotees worship the Supreme Lord to attain unalloyed devotion to the Lord. The Lord, however, is not worshipped by others who have no program for attaining love of God, which is the essential aim of human life. Persons averse to a loving relationship with God are more or less condemned by their own actions. The Lord is equal to every living entity, just like the flowing Ganges. The Ganges water is meant for the purification of everyone, yet the trees on the banks of the Ganges have different values. A mango tree on the bank of the Ganges drinks the water, and the nimba tree also drinks the same water, but the fruits of both the trees are different. One is celestially sweet, and the other is hellishly bitter. The condemned bitterness of the nimba tree is due to its own past work, just as the sweetness of the mango is also due to its own karma. The Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita 16:19, Tannaham dvisita kururan samsareshnu naradanaman krishpami adrasram ashuban asuvishevayo nishu. The envious, the mischievous, the lowest of mankind, these two I ever put back in the ocean of material existence into various demoniac species of life. Demigods like Nyamaraj and other controllers are there for the unwanted conditioned souls who always engage in threatening the tranquility of the kingdom of God. Since all the demigods are confidential devotee servitors of the Lord, they are never to be condemned. So just back to the original verse. The controlling deities of all the above mentioned physical elements are empowered expansions of Lord Vishnu. They're embodied by eternal time under the external energy, and they are his parts and parcels. Because they were entrusted with different functions of universal duties and were unable to perform them, they offered fascinating prayers to the Lord as follows. Om Magyanam Tiriram Dasya Granjala Shalakaya Daksho Om Midicham Yena Tatsmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Titanya Mano Bishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garamayam Dadati Svapatantikam He Krishna Kruna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namustate Vancha Kaupatru Bhascha Kripo Sindhure Vacha Patitana Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gurudevani Pracharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Prashachare Satadine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasadi Gaura Bhaktivedanta Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this verse and purport is quite obviously focused on the demigods. In modern scientific terms, the universe, most of the universe, is almost perceived as a cold, dark, largely empty place full of rocks and gases and stars and nebula and no life, as far as they are concerned, at least not so far. There may be some open-mindedness to life on other planets. However, largely, in the modern scientific perception, the universe, for the most part, is an empty place, but not so in the Vedic. In the Vedic view, the universe is teeming with life, millions of demigods, even beyond, completely beyond our perception, beyond our five senses. Not only in the history on the earth itself, but also right now in the heavenly planets and of course the lower worlds as well. So it's very interesting. So just focusing specifically on Prabhupada's purport here. Such control of the demigods is not superfluous. It is as necessary as the controlling departments in the affairs of a modern state. Which is quite interesting. I don't know, has anyone ever been to the Eden Project in Cornwall? Oh, hand straight up there, the gentleman over there. Yes. So it's a biosphere, basically, where you get, obviously you get tropical plants and other plants from around the world, not just plants, but insects as well, I believe, but especially plants, which don't normally grow or cannot grow in this rather damp, humid, cold climate of the UK. In other words, it's a glorified greenhouse, really, but it's a biosphere, which means it's a bit more, it requires a lot of management. I remember going there once, fascinating, with these Venus fly traps and, things you wouldn't get unless you're in the Amazon jungle, I suppose. But you get these guys, you see these men there working in suits. It's their job. They work for the biosphere, you see. And I remember walking through the tropical bit with these big, huge leaves and, these things that you get. It says, John, it's okay. Can you just turn down the temperature in the tropical sphere, please, and then open the windows? All right, Mike, okay. And things happen. In other words, they're managing it. They're managing the universal affairs of the biosphere. So in one sense, we could see that the Earth could be, in some ways, compared with a biosphere. And the demigods are controlling in a similar way that human beings are controlling their own little biosphere. Of course, Prabhupada says actually the human beings and birds and animals don't actually have very much control. But as humans, as terrestrial human beings on this planet, we can at least envision the idea that we have control over our the ecology of our back garden or the gardens at the manor, for example, or a biosphere in Eden and so forth. In other words, the concept that it's not all here by accident, it's not here by chance, the Eden Project, for example, or the gardens of Bhaktivedanta Manor or whatever, did not appear by chance, but they're managed. Of course, the demigods are superior because if it wasn't for them, they wouldn't, you know, the earth would be desolate, as it is at the end of every Kali Yuga and every partial devastation. It's the demigods that replenish the earth. Humans, we don't have that capability. At the partial devastation, it would be very difficult to revive the biosphere. You know, we ourselves are dependent. But nevertheless, that analogy, I think, gives us a general idea. And the Prabhupada compares the controlling of the demigods of the universe, many, many millions of planets, compared that to the affairs of a state. It's a bit like the macrocosm and the microcosm, where the demigods obviously see a much, much wider field, a much more wider vision of reality that we do. But in one sense, it's all relative, because the sense that we also, human beings, have some degree of control, not as much as we think. We are very much under nature. Nature can punish us and destroy humankind very quickly if it wanted to, just by like scratching an itch. However, there is a little bit of control there, a little bit of responsibility, at least in our own little area, where we can have some influence. We either have a nice garden or we don't have a nice garden. That's our choice, how much energy we put into it. But the demigods are almost inconceivably more powerful than us. For example, Lord Indra, we know he controls the rains and the precipitation, snow and hail and everything like that. And we can't imagine it. What, does he just sit there in an office and he's got like a lever? And he goes, "Oh, Indra, can you make it rain?" "Yeah, okay." There you go. Or, I mean, we can't quite imagine how he does it. But if we imagine how maybe the biosphere is managed, where it's going on, but every now and then it needs some kind of adjustment. And the demigods kind of get directly involved. Not only are they just letting things, just like the law of karma, it's kind of just going on. And the rain, especially in this country, it just goes on, you know. But if Lord Indra was very angry with us and wanted to send the Sambhataka cloud, he wanted to destroy us all, as he tried to do in Vrindavan 5,000 years ago, then he would make a special effort, you see. He would go, right, you know, mess around with the biosphere and start changing the controls and probably get the sack quite. In fact, Krishna gave Indra the sack in a sense. So, okay, you continue looking after the rain, but you're not to be worshipped, Lord Indra. The residents of Vrindavan will worship me. So let us go on with this. So that is real. The demigods are as real. Prabhupada actually says, hints the fact that a lot of people with poor fund of knowledge doubt the existence of the demigods based on the fact they can't see you. We can't see them. But nevertheless, imagine you're an insect, a fly or a butterfly. I actually went to a butterfly park thing, what do they call them? But you go in and there's all different kinds of, hundreds of different species of butterflies, beautiful butterflies around. But of course it's all managed, it's all in an enclosure. But the butterflies probably have no idea what's going on. Right? The butterflies don't have that, you know, they just know how to eat and survive, really, and they're fluttering around. And they're probably not aware of the fact that they're part of an exhibition of a biosphere or whatever it might be. They have no conception because it's not helpful to their survival, eating, you know, sleeping, mating and defending. That's what they're doing, and fluttering around. And they're kept, sometimes they even open the doors to the butterfly greenhouse, because in the greenhouse, is all their food and all the things they like. So they've got no interests to going out into the cold. You know, they're happy where they are. But they're kind of in a mire, in a sense, of the fact that they don't know anything beyond their senses. Human beings, most human beings are in the same category, but on a different level. But nevertheless, human beings are different, because we start to, you know, we build things like churches and temples, and, you know, we start to question our reality, unlike the animals. In fact, that's the only difference between us and apes, really, in that sense. But we're also very much part of the ecology of the world. We have a role in it, which is a dharmic one. But yes, and Prabhupada also gives reference in his purport. I think he mentions Lord Yamaraj three or four times actually in his purport, because he's saying, look, not all demigods are perceived as being glorious. It's most devotees will say, oh, I would love to meet Yamaraj at the time of death. Well, I mean, a good devotee wouldn't mind, because Yamaraj to them would appear as a glorious king or whatever. But to the sinful, Yamaraj appears as, well, less than a glorious king. You'd be terrified, because you'll be there to be punished by him. But here's the thing, in the affairs of a state, or if someone's working in a biosphere compound, someone's got to do the dirty work, you know. Someone's going to be a traffic warden. No one likes traffic wardens, especially if your car is parked in a double line, or you've paid for 1 hour, but you're 1 hour 10 minutes after, and you can see a traffic warden kind of making his way towards your car, and he's got his thing out. You know, that's not popular, right? You don't want that, because he's going to send you a fine. But Yamaraj's role is like that. He has to kind of punish, and without that punishment, there'll be no karma. Without that karma, there'll be no reformation in the material world. You know, the material world would not be in a position for it to function as a place of reformation, as a place of controlling the quality, let's say, the conditions of living in the spiritual world. Just like, again, with the affairs of a state, they need to build prisons. In fact, there's talk about, oh, we need more prisons and so forth. The prisons are full. I know, says a politician, let's build more prisons. You know, or can it be an open prison? Or can we punish them through community work? No, we still need more prisons for serious offenders. So these things go on in the in government, human government. But actually, the material world, the matattva, that what is not, the illusion, we are in a kind of a prison, you see, because we're not qualified yet to be in the spiritual world. Similarly, if a prisoner has just been an offender of the law, has been condemned to prison, then obviously he's not qualified to walk the streets. He's a mass murderer or he's whatever he is. He's got to be locked up. So we're locked up. But the funny thing about this prison, that the door is open, just like it is in the butterfly park, but the butterflies choose not to fly out, you know, because it's, you know, they've got enough food there, they've got enough sense gratification for them. They don't want to fly out into the cold English weather, you see. And it looks dark, but actually in the spiritual world, it's not cold and dark. It's quite the opposite. Here, it's cold and dark. But that one little test tube, that one little beaker of water in the Sahara Desert is what's keeping us here, actually. Because, you know, Krishna is more beautiful than Cupid multiplied a million times, says the Brahma Samhita. But we don't, in the condition, the souls don't understand or perceive or appreciate that beauty, because we're not looking enough at Krishna, basically. Let us move on. So what I wanted to do was to, because obviously, you know, at the end of the day, we are Prabhupada, in ISKCON, we are Prabhupada Anugas. We see Prabhupada's purports as being sastric in itself. You know, Prabhupada's purports are scripture to us. Because Prabhupada himself said, I did not write these books, this was written by Krishna. So, and also Prabhupada's statements. So what does Prabhupada actually say about the worship and the position of the demigods? So let's pick some examples here. Bhagavatam 6:16-38. A purport, of course. We may show our respect to the demigods, but the demigods are not worshipable. The intelligence of those who worship the demigods is lost because these worshippers do not know that when the entire material cosmic manifestation is annihilated, the demigods are also vanquished, and the benedictions given by them will also be vanquished, and so will the unintelligent men. So it's quite strong words there by Prabhupada, but he's basically saying the demigods, like us, or like the people who work in the biosphere, or whatever it might be, are temporary. So Lord Indra's body is temporary. Lord Brahma, even, yes, he lives for 311 odd trillion years by our calculation, but it's still temporary. You know, eternity minus 311 trillion equals eternity. Eternity minus three is still eternity. Because the concept of eternity is actually beyond our comprehension. It's beyond our mathematical common sense. Eternity is eternity. You know, eternity minus eternity is eternity. And these things we don't understand, because this is based on a law which does not exist in this material world, because this material world itself is not eternal. It is only in the spiritual world that things are eternal. But yet we are, by nature, eternal in the temporary. Let's see what else Prabhupada says about the demigods. Canto 7, chapter 6, 19 to 17. Just an extract from that. Those who are in Krishna consciousness, they're also called demigods. It's interesting. The citizens or the residents of the higher planets, they are also called demigods. In other words, elevated devotees, sincere devotees, are almost like demigods in the sense. In other words, demigods are devotees. They're superior to devotees, but they're not necessarily any more fortunate than those who are chanting Hare Krishna. It is said that the demigods, many of the demigods, pious demigods, would actually want to take birth on the earth to become part of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. Imagine that. Because they know they want to go back to Godhead. They're aware that in the demigod planets, the levels of enjoyment are so much higher there than they are here. But those who are sincere about going back home, back to Godhead, and many of them are, of course, great devotees of Vishnu, think, well, actually, okay, taking birth on the earth, that's a bad deal. You know, that is bad. You know, chicken pox, measles, school, weather, rain, cold, getting older, getting frail, going grey, aches and pains, all the things that, you get on the earth. That they're not getting so much in the heavenly planets. And yet, the benediction is the holy name. I can join ISKCON when I become a human or whatever I might do, take advantage of Lord Chaitanya's mercy, and then forget all this heavenly planet stuff and go to the lotus feet of the Lord in the spiritual world. Of course, you're sincere demigods. So actually, we can expect in the future, demigods will be taking birth on the earth. As well as demons, because it's a whole big battle. We even know demigods took birth on the earth to participate in Krishna's Leela. Abhimanyu, for example, who's the son of Arjun, took birth on the earth for only 16 years. He died in the battle of Kurukshetra, killed by the Maharathis unfairly in that battle. And he only lived to 16. But of course, Shishirada Gokula Nanda Ki Jai, Shitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Shishigoni Tai Ki Jai. He only lived to 16. But actually, it was written to be like that, because his mother didn't want him to be on the earth for too long. He actually wanted to leave his heavenly planet, take birth on the earth, and his family said, well, we'll miss you. I don't need to go on the earth. Okay, I'll go for 16 years. And the 16 years on the earth is just like, what is that by the calculation of the heavenly planets? Time is different there. 16 hours or 16 minutes or whatever it might be, depending on the level of the planet. So, so by earthly calculation, Abhimanyu was on the earth for 16 years. But in terms of his heavenly, heavenly abode mother, then maybe that wouldn't have been so long. So, you come back. Come back straight away. Let's continue. Bhavatam, 5th canto, 20th chapter, 3 to 4. The idea that Lord Vishnu is on the same level as the demigods is in contradiction to the Shastra. The demigods are not supreme, adds Prabhupada. The supremacy of the demigods is dependent on the mercy of Lord Narayan, Vishnu, or Krishna. So this is, of course, every morning, the devotees in the morning program, they said one of the 10 offences to the holy name is that one should not see the demigods, Brahma, Shiva, and so forth, as on the same level or equal to, or independent of Vishnu, the name of Lord Vishnu. They are demigods dependent on the Lord as we are dependent ourselves. But we respect them. Just like, for example, an important person, a king or queen or whatever, an ambassador of some type comes to the temple, they, you know, they'll probably be, I work in that department, so I know we're treated with a degree of respect. It's just etiquette. It's just the right thing to do. So similarly, if Narad Muni kind of walks into the temple room, we'll probably be, wow, it's Narad Muni. He's floating, my goodness me. But he'd be treated with respect. They're not supreme. They're not God, but they are bridges. Well, in terms of the demigods, they are like a bridge, or they are to God. You know, they are senior to you there, so you respect them. This is an interesting part of an interesting subject that was actually discussed upstairs in the 1970s. Prabhupada was discussing this subject with Graham Hill, the racing driver, who I think passed away actually, not all that long ago actually. Do you know when it was? I don't know. But he actually lived around here. He was a famous racing driver back in the 70s. He actually met Prabhupada upstairs in his room. And one of the quotes that Prabhupada made, we can also find in the Bhagavatam 7.6.1. Men of small intelligence worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods. But my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. I'll do one more quote, I think, from Prabhupada. In the Science of Self-Realization, Chapter 3, we can read, the rewards given by the demigods are temporary because any material facility must act in a connection with material facilities one gets, whether by modern scientific methods or by deriving benedictions from the demigods. Interesting. Anyway, the main point there is that the rewards are temporary. Prabhupada in his purports as well gives a reference, of course, to Mahavishnu. Because it's created by the glance of Mahavishnu, we know. We mentioned the material world, and in the spiritual world stretches for eternity, innumerable Vaikuntha planets, but in one corner of the spiritual world is the Mattattva, that what is not. It's like a cloud or a shadow of reality. And in that cloud we call the Mattattva, the illusionary energy. Mahavishnu, Vishnu, enters into that cloud and lies down and starts breathing. And in and out, innumerable universes come from the pores of his skin. And this is the basis of time, kala. In other words, there is no time before that. Well, before is also a word that references time. But, independent of the marked up for the material world, there is no time as we understand it. Everything by nature is eternal. But when Mahavishnu, in a half-sleep mode, is lying down in the causal ocean, and he's breathing in and out, the universes are created and then annihilated. And because of that annihilation, you have time. His breath is something like, by our calculation, is 311.40 billion or trillion years or something like that. Yeah, for the length of the universe. So innumerable universes are being created and then they are destroyed as Mahavishnu breathes back in. The largest kind of measurement of time, of course, the more kind of inferior you get, then the more kind of the smaller time periods you can deal with. And, we deal with seconds and milliseconds, and because we're more involved with the material energy. But to Mahavishnu, just a breath is 311 trillion years by our calculation. Puts things into perspective. I mean, he really is like, the captain of a very large biosphere. But of course, then he glances on Pradhana, the unmanifest material energy which is personified as Durgadevi. And that glance is personified as Lord Shiva. And that glance includes all the souls that have entered into this material world. And that glance is the original combination, actually, which sets or triggers off the material world in many respects. The ego that the conditioned souls are carrying, combined with the Mattattva, controls this layer of false ego. And from there, the false ego condenses into intelligence, mind, ether, air, fire, water, and earth. And within that, you have, of course, what we call the Brahmandala, or the universe, or Lord Brahma's egg. Under egg, Brahma, Lord Brahma. So it's like an egg-shaped universe. And there are billions of them. And we are just in one of them. Can you imagine that? I wanted to, we've still got about 10 minutes left, I think. I wanted to refer to another verse of the Bhagavatam, Bhagavatam 6.4.34. The Lord appears through lower systems of worship according to one's desires, although he appears as their demigods and not in his original form. Prabhupada, in that interesting verse, Prabhupada writes, the impersonalists imagine the various demigods to be forms of the Lord. For example, the Mayavadis do not actually believe in the form of the Lord, but for the sake of worship or culture, they imagine some form to be God. That's what they say. Generally, they imagine a form of Vishnu, a form of Shiva, forms of Ganesh, sun god and Durga, etc. But they don't actually believe they're persons, in a sense, for the most part. Or if they do believe the demigods are persons, they would say, well, beyond them is something impersonal. Whereas we would say, it's all personal. The demigods are persons. We're persons. The butterflies are persons. You know, dogs, cats are persons. We're persons. The demigods are persons. God is a person. The Mayavadis, though, at some point, when you get to the top, they'll say it's all this form and variety of persons. And then when they start getting to the demigods, and especially when they get to the supreme, they say, oh, no, that's not a person. Form and formlessness and love and variety and relationships comes from nothingness in their perception. Whereas for us, it's something, you know, life comes from life. Something comes from something else superior. That is the Vaishnava philosophy. Prabhupada goes on in that verse. The best are those who understand the Supreme Lord as completely blissful, spiritual, full of bliss, and completely distinct from that of the conditioned soul or any other living entity. Such philosophers are best because they know that the Supreme Personality of Godhead reveals himself differently to worshippers in various modes of material nature. They know that there are 33 million demigods. Just to convince the conditioned soul that there is a supreme power, and to induce him to agree to worship one of these demigods, so that they, in other words, they would work. They would one of the positive elements, aspects of worshiping the demigods, is that it trains people to accept the sense of a higher authority. So here's a positive element of it. Actually, you know, those who are in certain modes of nature may not be qualified or may not be inclined to worship Lord Vishnu or a concept where they have to follow certain regulatory principles. They're only interested in material gain, but the sense of worshipping or turning to a demigod for material benedictions is better than nothing because it trains them to accept a higher authority and a personal conception of reality. Which is interesting. Also, it is not that as Vaishnavas we do not disturb other people's faiths or other people's paths or their chosen form of worship, because that may be right for them. We preach to people, of course, but if someone is in the Gita, we find that he says, "Whatever one is, you know, I become that. You know, I can become manifest for that person." Ultimately, so that they begin on the spiritual path. Ultimately, when we take darshan of the deities, for example, we don't ask Krishna for things. We don't say, you know, oh, by the way, you know that cottage by the sea, I've got my eye on Krishna. Well, you know, that devotional service I did for you the other day, well, you know, perhaps you owe me one, you know. I mean, of course, that happens with the demigods, actually. But we, as Vaishnavas, we don't do that with Krishna. If Krishna does give us something materially pleasurable, great. If he doesn't, then that's also great, because it's an opportunity to make spiritual progress. We have to embrace humility. And that's kind of bhakti, really, where you're doing things but without any kind of motive for anything in return. That, in some ways, in my understanding, is probably the best way to describe bhakti in simple terms. And people, oh, how can bhakti be above gyan? Bhakti is just doing some physical service. Or how can bhakti be above ashtanga yoga, where, you know, you're meditating in the mountains and completely being beyond the bodily constraints? How can, I don't know, sweeping the corridor in the temple, how can that be high? Well, actually, if it's unmotivated and it's only for Krishna, then that is high. If it's motivated in some other way, then it's less high. So in other words, a lot of it is to do with our own motive and our own mentality. But bhakti, when it's practiced on the highest level, when it's understood and practiced properly, bhakti is the highest yoga system. But often it gets misunderstood. There are even people who wrote about Lord Chaitanya who described him in offensive ways as an epileptic or a fanatic or a sentimentalist. But to us, of course, that's not the case. He was exhibiting pure love of Godhead, and he is the incarnation of Radha and Krishna combined. So people, you know, some people, the scholars and so forth, it's kind of they see what they want to see, in a sense. So just to finish off, actually, I wanted to, on the subject of demigods, just for a few minutes, I wanted to share a little bit of an essay I wrote, actually, about the universe. As you do, you know, I think I write about the universe. It was just for a project I was doing. And it kind of covers, I believe, a lot of the similar subjects to what I've been discussing so far. I wrote here, the ancient scriptures of India suggest our search for intelligent life out there should not be restricted to what in Sanskrit is called sarivar shula, or gross body and senses. The Vedas tell of highly intelligent species that exist in realities beyond the instruments of contemporary science, shukshma sharira, a subtle body substance which is not physical matter, but is made of mind, intelligence, and ego. Things can exist that are not made of, you know, carbon-based matter. Even the gross earthly human body has a subtle body, sometimes called the astral or ghostly body. All eight elements exist throughout the universe, but in different proportions. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. A particular element will be more dominant in the occupants of different lokas or planets. For example, the predominant but not necessarily the only element in Brahmaloka is intelligence. So Lord Brahma's body is not made of gross earth like ours. It's made mainly of more subtle elements. That's why we can't see him. That's why he's so powerful. The bodies of the likes of Brahma and the other devas carry genetic information in the form of bijas or seeds that are made of largely subtle energy. So from the Vedic perspective, the existence of life elsewhere in the universe is not dependent on planets possessing specific earth-like conditions. The existence of bodies, which are mainly subtle, are more or less dependent on such a long list of special conditions that largely gross bodies are dependent on. In other words, our existence is very fragile. You know, if the earth heats up just by another 10 degrees or something, we're all finished, we're all dead. So, you know, if the earth is substantially nearer to the sun or further from the sun, if the earth doesn't spin at the speed that it does, if the earth isn't tilted at the angle it is, and so many things in place, so many conditions in place, that if something is just a little bit here, a little bit there, then we lose so much. In fact, this is topical for the environment. A few percent here, a few percent here, we lose so many species of life on the planet. We lose the coral reefs, which are being lost right as we speak due to climate change. So there's so many conditions. This earth is fragile. And it's managed by the demigods. If Lord Indra decides it's not going to rain anymore, we're finished. So just like in a biosphere, we're very dependent on higher powers. This earth is very delicate. A few percent here, a few percent there. There's so many conditions. Even the sun's rays are, if they were just a few percent bit more kind of measure of radiation in the sun, we'll be finished. A few percent less radiation and we're finished. Ozone layer, without the ozone layer, we're finished. There's so many different conditions, and it's got to last for billions of years throughout our history just for us to exist on this planet. The demigods don't have such restrictions. Demigods can live on the sun, they can live on the moon, but their bodies are more subtle. Their bodies are much different to ours, which makes them more flexible in where they can exist. Just to finish, this worldview is not exclusive to ancient Indian scriptures. Throughout the world, there are many tales embedded in folklore which include the interaction of humanoid beings from non-terrestrial realms, and indeed the visiting of such realms which operate under different laws of space and time. For example, in South Central Asia, we find the race of beings called the Nagas. They are said to be non-humans descended from Kasyapa and his wife Kadru. They are sometimes described as having a serpentine or snake form, and other times a human form. The Nagas have standard mystic powers, such as the ability to travel through solid matter, appear and disappear, and shapeshift, etc. So very kind of interesting. In other words, it's not only less auspicious beings like Asuras, and lower beings are also subtle and also exist, but we certainly do not pray to them. There are 14 different planetary systems or divisions throughout the universe, 7 lower and 7 above the Earth, ranked according to consciousness, I suppose you could say, basically, and also degrees of the elements of which their bodies are made. The lower planets are populated by beings that are kind of lower than us from a spiritual point of view, and of course, we know about the heavenly planets. So, I'll stop there, it's time.